Welcome to Open Drama UK's last episode of Series 2. A slightly longer episode than normal, as we follow up from Episode 9, where we explored the impact of maternity leave and returning to work as a drama teaching mother. This episode explores research being carried out by Dr. Crystal Wilkinson around fertility and the workplace, using the power of drama to show her research findings through ethnodrama. Crystal recommended that Caroline Biddle, an ex-drama teacher, turned fertility coach and fertility workplace consultant, joined us on this drama teaching podcast for her specific teacher and education experience relating to fertility. Please note that this episode does contain moments that listeners may find upsetting. Support and further reading are given in the episode details. We hope you find this episode informative and interesting.
Welcome to this month's Open Drama UK podcast. It's the last month in the series. You join us in July for the end of the academic year. And today I'm really pleased to introduce two fantastic ladies who are going to talk to us about the work that they have been doing. We're joined by Dr. Crystal Wilkinson, who's Senior Lecturer in Human Resource Management at Manchester Metropolitan University. Crystal comes from a HR background, and the work that she has been doing in her research is going to be quite fascinating to listen to today. We're also joined by Caroline Biddle, who's a fertility coach and a fertility workplace consultant. And Caroline's work looks at the fertility issues that are faced by teachers and the issues around fertility within the education sector. So, Crystal, if you'd like to go first and just sort of introduce yourself to listeners, explain a little bit about yourself, your background and the work that you're doing.
Hi there. Yes, my name's Crystal. Yeah, I'm a senior lecturer in human resource management and researcher in the Centre for Decent Work and Productivity. So my research projects, there's a few of them really, but they're all around kind of the work-life interface and well-being at work, and particularly kind of understudied groups and understudied topics. So my PhD was on work-life balance for managers and professionals, including teachers, who live alone and don't have children. And kind of, you know, quite often not really considered in terms of kind of policy and flexibility, and sometimes kind of feeling that they're not really entitled to as much kind of support for the work-life interface, and maybe having to kind of pick up for colleagues that maybe have more kind of legitimate or considered legitimate kind of non-work needs for their time. One of the issues that emerged from that was kind of, you know, I might want a family one day. I might not have one now, but I might want one. And it prompted me to kind of look into what do we really know about family formation, as opposed to, or, you know, the challenges in the workplace when you have a family, a young family particularly, and realised that there was very little on kind of fertility journeys, fertility treatments, pregnancy loss, etc. So that's the big project that I'm sort of coming towards the end of at the moment. And I'm also doing research on perinatal mental health and employment. So depression, anxiety in pregnancy and post-birth and related conditions.
Thank you. It's fascinating. I'm listening to you and remembering that I have to also guide the conversation. And I'm like writing it all down. Oh, fascinating. I'll look into that. And then Caroline, please, if you'd like to introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about you and your background and why you're joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Holly. So I'm Caroline and I'm actually a former drama teacher. I taught for 9 years, absolutely loved it, and now I've moved into fertility coaching and I'm also a fertility workplace consultant, and that, maybe we'll talk about that a little bit later on in the discussion, but that comes from my own personal experiences. That's where I'm at now. So as a fertility coach, I work one-to-one with teachers who are going through IVF, and that's to get them in the, you know, the right mental state, emotional state going into IVF. It's very different to counselling. And also as a fertility workplace consultant, I work with HR and leadership in schools, helping them to create a fertility workplace policy. And I also deliver training around fertility in the workplace.
Wow, that's incredible. And I think it would be helpful at this point if I kind of added some personal aspects to the nature of our conversation. I would say I'm fortunate. I'm very fortunate to have conceived both my children with you know, no issues. I mean, obviously I had to have my husband around, which is a bit of an issue in itself, but other than that, you know, and I do feel quite privileged to have, you know, I've had my children and my pregnancies and my births with, but I think sometimes people take that for granted, and you can't, if you've never experienced loss or you've never experienced challenges, it's kind of, we were talking before we started recording about, you know, a drama project where someone said that having a child is natural, and all, you know, things that within society that we take as being natural. And I've had conversations with students, I think as well, pregnancy is such an it is a personal thing, of course it is, but also it's a visible thing. Everyone can see when you're pregnant. And as a teacher, I think sometimes young people will ask you questions about, oh, am I having a baby? What are you having? And you do, it's only really now I go back and I reflect and I think, oh my goodness, thank goodness I did just get pregnant and my pregnancies were okay. Because I think when you're in that very public arena and you have young people asking you things, sometimes without sensitivity, because what, you know, why would they have those sensitivities? They don't appreciate those things in life yet. And I just wondered, Caroline, from some of the work that you've done and some of the coaching you've had with colleagues, do they talk about that and the fact that it's such a public thing and that can be quite sometimes insensitive without people realising?
You mean going through fertility treatment, that's quite a public thing, or?
Well, I don't know, actually. Would it be quite a public thing? I suppose the school might know about it from like a HR perspective if they're needing time off.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the problems actually with fertility treatment, that you can't use annual leave as a teacher. You can't, you know, you can only plan so much with fertility treatment. It'd be great if we could guarantee that during the 6 weeks holiday, you get all your treatment in and no one knows, and then you get a positive pregnancy test at the end. But we can't guarantee that. So unfortunately, teachers, it eats into the academic year. And part of the problem is, like I've just said, we can't use annual leave, teachers can't use annual leave, and they do end up having to, you know, go full disclosure to HR, to the senior leadership team, to their managers. And it's a very personal and private topic that, you know, a lot of people don't want to talk to their closest friends and their closest family members about it. So having to talk to HR and school leaders about it, and knowing that everyone, so in some cases, they do share it amongst the senior leaders, they all know what's going on, and then that leads on to potentially you start thinking as a teacher, and this is what a lot of the teachers have concerns with, that their career is then over, they're not going to be considered for these promotions.
Just listening to you makes me again think about that privilege, you know. I feel so heartless now that I said things, or I thought things like, well, you know, we'll get pregnant at Christmas because then I'll have a September child, you know, and that was my level of planning, and that was it, done, not a problem. You take that completely for granted.
Yeah, but I was the same, Holly. It's nothing to feel guilty about. I remember getting married in the August and thinking I'll be pregnant by the December. And then, like you say, you're carried away. And then it's only when you go through this that you think, oh, okay, it is a privilege for people to conceive naturally. And it just starts to make you a lot more aware.
One in seven couples struggle with infertility. You know, infertility is a disease of the reproductive system, according to the World Health Organization. One in five women are childless at midlife, and 90% of those, it's not by choice. One in four pregnancies ends in miscarriage. You know, fertility treatment is needed if you've got a medical infertility, but also same-sex couples, safest route to parenting, women who haven't met a partner but want to pursue motherhood. You know, it's a hugely common occurrence and experience, these complex fertility issues. But it is silenced, it is taboo, you know, it's not anybody's fault really that we say things and we think things, because we don't have the education at a young age about this. The narrative in schools is about contraception, you know, a sex education is don't get pregnant, you know, and there's, well, I'm not saying that school children should be getting pregnant, but you know, there's a sort of a campaign being led by Professor Joyce Harper at the moment, which is, you know, fertility education in schools, you know, including your options, including success rates of IVF. People think, you know, oh, if I struggle, I'll just do IVF. And it's like, they don't really know what IVF entails. They don't know the success rates. They don't know the eligibility criteria that the hoops you have to jump through to get it funded, and the costs if it's not funded, you know, some of the complexities. So it can be you know, it can be scary, I suppose, scary thing to kind of think about, and it is, but you know, education is power, isn't it? And in terms of changing attitudes in the workplace and in society, that people need support with this and need accommodations for this. You know, I'm all for there being legislative entitlement to time off for fertility treatment and things like that, because it is the impact is so significant on people emotionally as well as physically and socially and financially, and everything else. But just going back to what you were saying before, kind of around assumptions, I think that's another thing that I've heard quite a bit around teachers as well, is that if you're going through a complex fertility journey, not just fertility treatment, but coming to terms with infertility, coming to terms with childlessness if IVF is unsuccessful, coming to terms with pregnancy loss, is the assumptions that female teacher is a mother. So, you know, there's apparently quite a lot of assumptions from the students and from parents, you know, that, well, you know what it's like. And then if you sort of say that you're not a parent, then they're kind of almost questioning, well, how can you be telling me how to raise my child? And it's this kind of pronatalism in society and pronatalism in the teaching profession particularly, that makes you somehow less of a person if you're not a parent. And so it's just another angle to kind of throw in there.
And teachers have said to me, just to jump in, that something that stayed with them, one particular teacher said to me, that a teacher turned around to her and said, well, how can you possibly understand what this child's going through? You're not a mother yourself. And this teacher was going through fertility treatment. So yeah, it comes back to the pronatalism in the workplace, mm-hmm. like Crystal said.
And again, a perception sometimes, not necessarily in teaching, this has come out across our research, that like, if you've not visibly been pregnant or got children, that it's a choice, you know, that you're a career woman, that, you know, that you're somehow, you know, is it you, we don't know why, because some people are child free, you know, they've chosen that's works for them. But, you know, a lot of people are maybe not happy with the fact that they don't have children, and we can't assume that they've done it for any particular reason. So any assumptions really about somebody's choices or parental status or not is not necessarily helpful.
Yeah, where you were talking, I was just thinking about, you were saying about sex education. I was just, to go back to that point around, you know, how we talk about safe sex and contraception. I had a conversation yesterday with our HR department, actually, because we were sent information from a company that wanted us to think about menopause and how we educate colleagues around, you know, the end cycle, you know, the end of the periods. And I was thinking, this is quite, because she replied to me and she said, what, for the students, you want to put this in the curriculum? And I said, well, I'd have to have that conversation with the science department, but I was forwarding it to you in HR in case this is something that's helpful for you with colleagues. And she said, oh, I thought you wanted to put it in the science curriculum. And then I kind of paused on the telephone to her and I thought, I wonder if we do actually teach, because that's, you know, we get told how to get started in life, you know, you're going to get these things are going to arrive and this is why it is, and then don't have sex because you'll get pregnant. We don't say, like you just said, Crystal, oh, actually you might struggle to get pregnant, and actually when you're in your mid-50s or maybe early 50s, or you might even get something called early, but we just don't talk about it. Well, I was never taught about it. I'd have to check with the science department. I might get shot, they might say, Holly, we do teach it. I'm like, oh, sorry. But it just really made me think, and you know, there's so much within life that we could cover within our teaching, and yeah, because you know, education is power, isn't it? And it helps us to fathom what's going on in the world.
Like society though, women's health in general is a bit taboo. You know, there's talk about like endometriosis diagnosis taking a huge amount of time because there's just maybe not been the funding historically to explore the causes. PMDD, so premenstrual dysphoric disorder, you know, which is kind of a cyclical illness that kind of flares up with your monthly cycle, that can be debilitating, and a lot of people never heard of it. Menopause has been a huge increase in interest recently, you know, Davina McCall's documentaries and things like that, and there's a lot going on about the workplace, menopause in the workplace at the moment. There's, you know, government interested in it as well. But it's all very recent when you're considering it's such a, you know, it's like half your workforce. If you say, you know, roughly half your workforce is going to be women, in particular industries, teaching being one of them, healthcare, social care, you know, it's more than half, you know, more than half your workforce. And it's going to happen to them. It's going to happen to them all. Like, why are we not talking about it? But, you know, the in terms of work and employment, there have been like revolutions in interest in mental health for a long time. Didn't talk about mental health. And now there's a lot of support around mental health. Cancer at one point, you know, we don't, the C word, we don't say that, and, you know, it's a, it's great that there's more, there is more interest in these topics. I'm hoping fertility will be one of the big things, like menopause is a big one at the moment. We're trying out in Caroline. There's quite a few of us that are campaigning in this area that we need, you know, we do need to get it on the agenda, get support. Okay. And the business case for that support, you know, there is a clear business case.
And the teachers that I talk to in schools currently, they're almost frustrated with the menopause policy. The more mature members of staff are saying to them, this is great, you know, we're putting this in place for you. And they're not saying this back, but they're thinking, well, that's wonderful, but I need something else now. I need support for the IVF treatments I'm going through. I need support for the two babies that I've lost in the last 12 months and I've had to come back to work the next day. So it's great that there's this trend of menopause policy. Thank you very much, Davina McCall. But, you know, we almost need another Davina for fertility issues in the workplace on TV so that everyone goes, oh, wow, this is a thing. I never knew that, you know, and that happens. And it does affect men as well. And going back to the ethnodramas, there's a great one, Man Up. And that's from a man's perspective of going through infertility. And in my relationship, we were infertile due to male infertility. And it does affect men as well as women. I think a lot of people forget that. But I think it does come under women's health more so because it's the women that have to go to these fertility appointments. It's the women that go through the physical experience of the miscarriage and you need time off at home. It's about workplaces being inclusive, that, you know, it affects men as well as women.
Yes, I've got a colleague at the moment. I did check with her before I said this because I thought that might not be very sensitive of me. So that, I suppose it's in the back of my mind. It's the topic of being taboo and the fact that we shouldn't talk about these things. But, you know, maybe we should. So I'm going to talk about her. I'm going to get upset when I talk about her because she's so phenomenal. I hope she listens to the podcast. She'll be like, oh my God, you fruitcake, why did you start crying? You're such a drama teacher. She's a chemistry teacher and she's leaving profession this summer. She's giving up because she's gone through her first round of IVF and it didn't work. And obviously she is a scientist herself and she said, I don't think it's going to work while I'm working because I'm just too stressed. She said, my mental health and well-being with my job, because the teaching profession, there's lots of us saying it. She said, I have to stop. I have to take a break from teaching because I'm not going to be able to get pregnant whilst I'm still teaching. Well, you know, that's what she feels at this stage. And you two will probably know more about that in terms of research and the knowledge you have. But I went into her office when I realised that she was going to be leaving. And I said, oh, I'm so sad that you're leaving. You know, where are you going? Sort of expecting her to say, oh, you know, I'm going down there and I'm going to do this. And when I did what I just did then, actually, when she said why she was leaving, oh God, burst out crying. I felt awful that I hadn't realised that this was going on and that, you know, I wasn't there to support. But she said, you know, well, you wouldn't know. I kept it to myself and I can't get pregnant. So I'm leaving because I've got to think about myself and, you know, what I want. And I can't do that. And it just made me so mad that I thought we're in a society where a colleague who is really good at what she does doesn't have, you know, the systems in place and the setup around it to allow her to have a family and carry on working. And just really frustrated me.
Well, sending all the love to your friend, the chemistry teacher. It's often that that teachers, even if they are supported and they've got the best head teacher that says, you take all the time off that you need. I think there's that guilt that comes with teaching that you're letting so many people down. And it's like you said, she's a chemistry teacher, she's rare, she's a chemist. And maybe she feels as well, there's not somebody that can pick up that workload. And I was the only drama teacher in both schools that I worked at, and I remember feeling guilty that there was no one else there to support the lessons, that was someone on cover and they weren't going to give the children the best, you know, opportunities. They were just going to sit at the computer in the corner and let the students get on with it. And then you start thinking about all this, that there's, I'm letting the students down, I'm letting my colleagues down who are covering me. Well, the survey that I've got with fertility issues teaching, if you're going through fertility issues or you've had fertility treatment in the last 10 years, you can actually contribute to the survey. Because the data at the moment, we've not finalised it, but at the moment, 99.1% of teachers have said that they found fertility treatment emotionally challenging. So if you are then going to work and you're dealing with all these extracurricular activities, and there's also the triggers from the children, if there's a bad, you know, behaviour, normally you could be the teacher who nails behaviour management, and you go to school one day and you're upset from the fertility treatment that you're going through. You've just come back from an appointment at the clinic and it was bad news, or even it was good news, you're still in a different headspace, and then you've got that child that says the wrong thing that triggers you, and suddenly, you know, you're crying in a cupboard because you just haven't got the toolkit and you can't hold it together. Everything becomes personal.
Is it similar in other work environments, Crystal, do you know from your HR knowledge?
Yeah, so what our research was 80 in-depth, it's called biographical narrative interviewing, which is basically kind of tell me your story is kind of how we started. And we were interested in kind of complex fertility journeys. So it wasn't particularly like IVF and work, it was the whole kind of chronology from starting to try for children through to the point of interview. And for some people that was a point of interview after they'd had children, for some people it was a point of interview after they decided to stop the journey and come to terms with involuntary childlessness. Some people were still in the middle of their journeys and they were like, you know, we've going into our next round, for example. But we talked about kind of the range of experiences. And those that we talked to men, we talked to women, we talked to same-sex couples, heterosexual couples, some women would assume motherhood alone, and from a huge number of different industries. We also spoke to line managers and fertility counsellors to kind of get a rounded picture. And one of the key findings was just the huge variety of challenges that people faced. It was a very individualised experience. But what we talked about is kind of reproductive labour. So there's like a lot of work that needs to go into your fertility journey. So there's researching your condition, there's body work, you know, following medical advice, trying to kind of including, you know, let's not get stressed is a typical one as well. But, you know, there's engaging with forums to try and get some peer support if you don't know anyone who's gone through this. There's a lot of kind of work outside of you know, the work of your job. So you've got your job work and then you've got your reproductive work. And then the logistical challenges is one. So if people aren't familiar with IVF, it's, you know, there's medications that you have to kind of inject medications quite often, sometimes daily clinic appointments for blood tests and ultrasounds. It's all linked to the menstrual cycle. So you can't pick and choose when you have these appointments. And the clinics will have very strict operating schedules a lot of the time. Some people, their clinic is not close to where they are. For some people, they're even traveling internationally because of the funding situations and their own situation. So for example, if you're a same-sex couple, to get NHS funding for IVF, you need to prove you've been trying for a year. So how do you prove you've been trying to get pregnant for a year when you're a same-sex couple? Well, you have to do 8 rounds of IUI. So there's lots of different hoops that people have to jump through. So logistically, you know, how do you work out how to attend your appointments? And there's certain jobs you've got an advantage there because you've got flexibility built into your job. So some of the academics that we spoke to, for example, my job, you know, I'm very flexible. I need to be there for a lecture and meetings, but I can be a bit more flexible around that. And certain professional roles, they've got quite a bit of flexibility. So that's kind of good for them. But the downside of that is that you quite often have to make up those hours. So you're still doing your 40 hours. So if you had flexibility to spend all the morning dealing with your clinic, then you're working all evening. And if it's secondary infertility and you've got an existing child, how do you do that when, so, you know, there's, and working weekends, to, you know, so there's challenges like that. A lot of certain industries here don't have flexibility. It's the healthcare settings, you know, frontline work, there might be, you're stuck to your shifts. Teaching is another one, you know, you're quite stuck to the lessons that you have to teach. And yeah, but echoing what Caroline said there in terms of a key challenge that came up with the teachers that we spoke to was arranging cover, and then the additional work of, you know, I have to first of all arrange for a supply teacher, then I have to prep them, then I have to check it went well afterwards. And he said, so what would have been 1 hour's work for me doing the lesson is now like 5 hours work. That, so I missed that hour because I was at the clinic, and there's these 5 hours that I've got to find from somewhere to prepare it all. So the various different logistical challenges, trying to find somewhere at work to inject medication can be a problem, trying to find somewhere to have very sensitive telephone calls with the clinic So they can be ringing on a daily basis to say like how the progress of your kind of, you know, from extracting the egg and sperm through to it being like a viable embryo to transport, that you can have like daily calls of how many have survived to the next stage. It's really upsetting, you know. So yeah, there's those sort of challenges, social challenges in terms of people feeling like they're not being honest at work, they may be lying to people, being triggered by a pregnant colleague. So, you know, or in your instance, it might be a young children or parents who are pregnant who have, you know, talking about the sibling for little Johnny or whatever it is, you know, that's on its way. There's kind of social challenges, huge financial challenges for a lot of people, and as Caroline said, the huge emotional roller coaster that people are on. It's we talk about cycles of hope and grief. You know, you every month, you know, you're hopeful, and then, you know, there's not, there's for some people coming to terms with childlessness at the end of it, or very difficult decisions about, you know, do we go for another cycle? Do we put ourselves through this again? When do we do that? A lot of, you know, your chemistry teacher friend is very much not on her own. She's not an exception in terms of a lot of people have made very, very difficult decisions about their jobs. That's one of the heartbreaking things about these is we talk about identity and identity threat, and when you're going through a fertility struggle, you know, there are huge identity issues that go on about it. It goes to kind of the heart of who people are as a woman. You know, it's like, my body's failing me. Women should be able, I should be a mother. It should be easy. And I'm failing. My body's not doing what it should. I can't give my wife a baby. There's something, I'm less of a man or whatever it is. And then to also, you know, so for a lot of people, your professional identity becomes stronger in a way. For some people, your profession is a distraction from going through that. It's where you feel confident. But if then your job is compromised because time out for treatment and stuff made you feel that you can't go for a promotion, or you're going to get discriminated against, or I can't focus at work because the medication's sending me, you know, got into brain fog or whatever it is, you know, it's the potential is there that you feel like you're failing on both counts. And that, you know, that is one of the heartbreaking things, is that there's not the recognition of that, and there's not the protection, there's not the legislative protection against discrimination, for example, that you would get with maternity and you get with other things. So people are literally risking everything for the chance of being a mum or a dad, and, you know, it might not work. So it's, yeah, you're not the only one who's been in tears, you know, engaging with this topic. I'm sure Caroline's had her moments too.
Wow, absolutely. And I remember going for a meal with the first school I worked at, went for a meal with one of my good teacher friends. She's still a really good friend, and I was really upset. She was really upset, and she said to me, "You do know you can't stay at this school, Caroline. It's not working. You've really got to, you can't go through another round of IVF. This upset, this angry, this frustrated, it's just not going to work." And it's almost like a light bulb moment, and I went, "You're right, I need to go." And I'd been at that school for 7 years. She was really upset to see me go, as you are, Holly, for your friend, but I knew that I couldn't stay there. So I had made the decision to leave my teaching position and focus on getting pregnant, which, so, you know, who focuses on getting pregnant? But actually, it is a full-time job, like Crystal's just said, all the administration, all the phone calls. And then a head teacher at a local school found out I was leaving, offered me a position, and I was very blunt and said to him, no, thank you, because I actually want to get pregnant and go through fertility treatment, so I'm not going to be a very good drama teacher because I just want to, that's my main focus, the children aren't going to be my priority, sorry. And he said, okay, well, you know, thank you for being very honest with me, you didn't have to tell me all that. But then, as it turns out, he said that because I'd been so honest with him, that actually worked in my favor, you know, whether that's true or not. But I did work there, and it didn't work out for other reasons at that school, for different reasons, but I did. He was a very supportive head teacher at that school. There was no policy, there was no training again around fertility issues in the workplace, but I was allowed to go to all my appointments, I was allowed to go to my fertility. What is that all about? I was allowed to go and try and, yeah, anyway. So I went to my appointments, I was paid, there weren't any questions, I wasn't expected to fill out any absent request forms, I just had to text him. It was all really informal, and I felt that it was wonderful that he knew my situation. I didn't have to explain myself to all these other people. you know, his PA didn't have to know about it. It was, and then it was, so I did feel really supported in that sense. But the first school I worked at, and this will be relatable for other drama teachers, is I was penalised by having my pay stopped when I was going out for these appointments. It was down to the hour, and like, well, you know, yeah. And logistically, the clinic was an hour and 15 minutes away. And I felt like I was racing to get there, racing through my appointment, racing back. And it's just, what is that all about? That's not healthy. That's not a great mindset to have. And yeah, so the money was taken out of my wages. And I remember going to this head teacher and saying, but I come in during the school holidays and I rehearse with 100 children for a school show that I don't get paid for. I come in on the school holidays, I don't get paid for it. I'm okay with that. Yeah, don't pay me because I love it. I love to be there. But you're taking money from me. Shouldn't I be? What? And I was going, what's going on? And then I said, how about rehearsals for the GCSE and A-level performances? I come in and I give about 3 days for that. No, I don't ask you to do that. Okay, but if I didn't do all these things, do you realise the results would be very different? Who cares really at the top? Nobody. As long as you produce the results and you're not asking for extra money.
Can I add something there from a HR perspective? So there's something in the literature in HR called the psychological contract. I don't know if you've come across that, but it's basically like the unwritten expectations that parties have. And that is an absolute classic example of like psychological contract breach or violation. You know, it's like you have your contract of employment, yes or no, but you go over and above. And then you expect a little bit of that reciprocity back, you know, and it's just a really obvious sign of like really, really bad management. It's they're getting very little out of that by docking you those shifts, but the impact on your engagement, whether how much you're going to go the extra mile in future, your decisions around how much effort I put in, how much I care. It's like it's such bad HR. It's just such bad people management. And it's just like
That's so true. The school that I'm in at the moment, that the support that I've had with, you know, my own two children, I remember when I came back from my maternity, it was in the March, my daughter's born. I took a year. Fortunately, I was financially able to do that, but that's another whole podcast in itself. So, but I came back, but then I had two children that, and my eldest wasn't ready, he didn't start school till September. And I remember saying to the HR department and the head, I just can't afford to put both of them in childcare April, May, June and July, 5 days a week. I have to use my savings to pay. So they gave me a phased return to work. So I worked 2 days, then three, then four. And it just gradually built back up. And actually, not only was it psychologically brilliant for me, because I just thought, oh, thank you so much for doing that. They also allowed me to have a handover back from the person who'd been there, and they extended that person's contract until the summer as well. And like, that's not a big deal, you know, and I'm making out, you know, like, isn't that amazing? But it feels like it's amazing when you hear other people's absolute horror stories. And some of the other things that you've been mentioning about, you know, our own personal, and can obviously tell I'm an emotive person, people's emotions, and you know, going into a school and you know, standing there in front of 30 young people and them not necessarily, why would they have an understanding of what's going on in your life or whatever. 3 years ago I was I'd gone back, it was actually on my phased return to work. This isn't start of life related, this is end of life. And so my father was 62, was really fit and healthy. He had a cardiac arrest and just gone, bang, lights out. And I had this phone call. I was on a course at the time and I got on the train. I've said to you earlier, Caroline from Herefordshire. So I got on this train and I tried to bomb it back home. You know, I remember ringing my, at the time, vice principal, she's now the principal, and saying, my dad's dead. And she was just like, what? Right. See you in September. And that was it. They didn't pester me, they didn't phone, they didn't, of course they kept in touch with me, I was okay, but I had full pay for all of July, all of August, and you know, there was no qualms about it. And I actually was meant to, it was part of that phase return, and in the so I'd gone when I was on three, my dad died when I was doing 3 days, and then in the July I should have gone up to 4 days, and I thought, oh, they'll probably keep me on this, but they didn't, they honoured it, they gave me the 4-day pay for the whole of July and the August, and you know, why wouldn't they? way. Crystal's probably got a HR brain on going, yes, that's right. But I was so it just made that horrific experience so much better that I knew I was going to get my salary and I knew they cared about me. So I know that's not to do with the start of life, that's the end of life. But, you know, it's things like that that really make you appreciate, and it does make you want to give more because you just think, oh, you do, you know, you value me.
And that is a really, that is a relevant example, actually, Holly, because the difference between death and fertility treatment is that fertility treatment is elective. Well, why don't you just go and adopt? You're choosing to do this to yourself. Now, that's the common, people who don't understand, that's the go-to response. So just relax, why are you doing it? So it's almost like a lot of people who don't understand fertility treatment, they lack the compassion because of that lack of understanding. Whereas I suppose death, everyone in on some level can relate to that, can't they? But not everybody can personally relate to fertility treatment, fertility issues.
All of this, the work-life interface in general, you know, support for non-work issues, it's so variable by context. So, you know, legislation helps in certain areas. So, you know, there's legislative guides that suggest maternity leave, paternity leave, etc. But it's still very, very variable in terms of, you know, who gets what and whether it's enforced and the culture of an organisation, whether it's, you know, it's a dumb thing, and financially whether people can make it work, obviously, is extra layers. But in our research particularly as well, the organisation culture is one thing, but your line manager, just how approachable is your line manager? Can you tell them? Do you think they'll be supportive? Are they actually supportive? Had a huge, huge difference on people. Our research shows it can be done well. You know, within those 80 interviews, it was certainly not all doom and gloom. You know, there was the challenges that people experienced, but also there was, you know, feelings of huge amount of loyalty to your organization because they supported me through this, huge amounts of positive self-esteem and identity that, look, I managed this, I went through this really challenging thing and I still performed at work. And, you know, so there's, I think with the right support and with the right awareness and with the right policies and with the right training, you know, it and hopefully this is the way we're going, that in the future it won't be such a big thing. It'll be something that, you know, will be facilitated a lot better.
I almost forgot we're doing a podcast. I'm just like really enjoying my chat with my friends. I know you're both going to have to go soon because you have other things and other demands on your time. But before we go, I'd really like it, Crystal, if you could just explain about your ethnodrama and what's happened with your research, and I mean, as much as you can, obviously, ethically within what you're doing, and kind of how that, for listeners, how what you're researching, and, you know, you're not a drama specialist, it's not your background. Yeah, if you could just give us an overview and an understanding of that work, because I think people will find it really fascinating.
Yeah, okay, so I mentioned before that there's very little prior research sort of done in this area. So one of the main kind of aims and objectives for me was kind of from a research perspective to understand, you know, what are the challenges of intersecting a complex fertility journey with employment. But another main goal is raising awareness in different stakeholder groups, including HR professionals, organization owners, line managers, employees themselves around these issues. And so we were interested in, well, how do we, you know, how do we creatively disseminate our findings? You know, it's one thing to find out some interesting stuff and to write some academic journal articles, but that's really not going to get to the audiences that might actually benefit from this knowledge. So when I was planning this research, I came across this method called ethnodrama, which is about creatively disseminating research findings to kind of lay audiences. So, you know, people who aren't specialists in the research. But ethnodrama is kind of fictionalized accounts that come directly from research data. So we did our data collection. So we spoke to our 100 participants. We did our kind of online review part of the project. And then we're working with a creative consultant. So she's a poet, performance poet called Jenny Berry. And what we've done is we went to her with fully anonymized transcripts of our data and key themes that we identified, and we said, we want you to create some little vignettes, some little scenes that just bring the issues to life, bring the themes to life, and catch people's attention and promote discussion and debate as well. So she's been working with us, and we've ended up with five kind of little various types. So one's spoken word poem, a multi speaker, spoken word poem. So it's like, it's about managers, the challenges for managers, and they're all coming in with like different issues that they've faced. One's a monologue, and that's the one that Caroline mentioned before, Man Up, which is the man's perspective. One is a HR meeting where you've got basically it's a performance issue has been spotted and has prompted a HR meeting where you've got HR manager, department manager, and an employee. And as part of that, you know, we've noticed that X, Y, and Z has been going on, and she's like, comes out with that she's been on this complex fertility journey with multiple rounds of IVF and pregnancy losses. And it's, well, how is that handled in the moment by a manager and a HR who didn't expect that to come up? One is around kind of some of the challenges for different demographic groups, so same-sex couples and a solo mum pursuing motherhood alone. And the final one is around childlessness as a potential end of a complex fertility journey. So what we're doing with those is obviously using them to raise awareness. So we've had a couple played on like local radio and things, but most importantly to build them into sort of line manager training sessions or university lectures. Like I'm including them in some of my lectures for potential future HR professionals on like understanding the work-life interface and well-being at work. But it's something that I think, you know, was an eye-opener to me really, and interdisciplinarity, you know, that we can really learn from the different disciplines, and drama I think does bring things out in a much more engaging way than we could ever get just through talking or writing papers on things.
Well, your audience listening to this podcast will obviously definitely agree with you, because we all advocate for, you know, learning by doing and, you know, how we engage and how we retain information and what we learn through performance. Caroline, just before we go, obviously you are a drama teacher in a previous life, and you have all this experience. Have you seen some of the work that Crystal's been talking about, or, you know, what are your feelings from as a drama specialist, but with such an understanding of this topic?
Well, when I found out that Crystal was working with Jenny Berry to create the ethnodramas, I was really excited that, you know, that there are ethnodramas out there to support line managers. And they are really helpful resources to listen to these scenarios from different walks of life, from, you know, from the HR, the man at the football match, and the monologue going through. Well, living with male infertility, yeah, they are superb.
How can people access them?
Yeah, so we've got two audio clips that are already uploaded onto our project website, and then we've got three that are under construction, under development, that will be making available soon.
So before we go, could both of you just share kind of any information that you think would be helpful for listeners if they've really enjoyed what we've talked about, really enjoyed, if they've found what we've done, maybe they have enjoyed it. That's me talking about being taboo again, isn't it? If they've got lots out of today, and, you know, if there's any further research that you recommend people look at, or some blogs, anything you think people should follow on, or any particular organisation to follow on social media.
Well, there's a number of large national charities that are in this space. So Fertility Network UK is obviously the kind of one of the go-to resources for kind of forums with other people going through similar experiences. Lots of information there as well. That's mainly, you know, for people who are going through this. There's particular things around parts of the journey. So there's a number of dedicated charities around pregnancy loss, so Tommy's and other miscarriage charities, and Gateway Women might be of interest for people who are kind of at the end of a journey without children. So that's the kind of the childlessness network community, but honestly, if it's, you know, Caroline's the person that I would, if I ever found out anyone was grappling with this as a professional who wanted to know more about how they can support their staff or a teacher, it's Caroline.
There we go. Caroline, anyone you'd like to recommend?
Well, thank you very much, Chris, that's really kind. What I will say is that if there's anybody who is about to go through Tilly's treatment, or who is anxious about having a conversation with HR or with their head teacher, if you go to Fertility Issues in Teaching, there's a little resource tab at the top, and you can download a free resource that has some exemplar emails and what you might include when you have that conversation or that initial email with the head teacher to make them aware. And also, there's, like I mentioned earlier, there's a survey, and if you go onto either Twitter or Instagram, you'll find me on there. For Twitter, it's foot_teaching, and click on the link at the top, the bio, and the survey's there. I've kept it open a little bit longer, just, you know, again, for opportunities like this to speak on your podcast, Holly, and if there's anyone else going through Silly treatment or has done in the last 10 years, they can contribute to that survey. So yeah, resources and survey on Silly Tissues and Teaching.
I think when that survey is available, that'll be a really, really useful tool for people when they're trying to start conversations in their schools, you know, to actually say, look, this isn't just me. look at these themes. And we've got a report for employers. It's not specific to the teaching profession, but it's a report for employers that's got a list of kind of recommendations for how to become more fertility friendly, as well as going into, you know, the details of some of the findings that have come from, you know, across our study. So
thank you both so much for joining me today and contributing with your wealth of knowledge. Thank you. I don't really know what else to say. I've learned so much in the last hour recording this with you. It's unbelievable. It does make me realise just how I need to take my love for people and just back that with some knowledge and some understanding. And then I won't just look at people and cry. I can actually, you know, go, right, this is what we can do. We're going to go to this and be more practical other than just show my empathy. So thank you both so much for what you've shared and for how helpful you've been.
Thanks, thank you for having us. And don't underestimate the impact of empathy, though.
Absolutely.
Thank you for joining us throughout Series 2 and for today's last episode. We hope you'll join us again for Series 3, which will restart in September. Until then, please go back, re-listen and re-enjoy all of Series 1 and Series 2.